Devoncast
from Radio X.
Hello and welcome to Devoncast, all the issues that matter in the county from Radio X in association with the Local Democracy Reporting Service. I'm Paul Nero and I'm editor of the service, which is funded by the BBC in Devon. And we combine the stories collected by our four local democracy reporters with other content from Radio X. Two of those reporters aren't around at the moment. Guy Henderson is taking a break, which is why I'm here. And get well soon, Will Goddard, who should be back in action next time round.
And I'm Alison Stevenson. I'm still here covering Plymouth, Torridge, West Devon and North Devon.
And I'm Brad Gerrard. I cover Devon County Council and Mid Devon. And this week, above that, fill in a bit for Guy as he's off. So also looking into Exeter, Teignbridge and East Devon.
I don't know what edition of Devoncast we're on, but it's probably now in the region of 20. And thank you to all of you who stream the show on the Radio X app or from your favourite podcast provider. But welcome too if you're listening now on Devoncast Radio. That's the new digital station from Radio X on DAB across much of the south of the county, where we can be heard by about half of Devon's population, along with a small range of other programmes too, and we'll explain more about that later.
Devoncast
from Radio X.
Among our stories in this edition, like it or loathe it, the Plymouth Landmark Tower, which is finally going to come back into use after years of being left to rot.
Devon devolution, why just a little bit of power and money may be coming from Westminster to the county, and we'll try and make it interesting.
And what to do with levelling up millions of pounds in Torridge and low traffic neighbourhoods, love them or loathe them too.
And to help us through some of the issues this week, we've got a guest, a Green, in the form of Diana Moore, who's an Exeter City Councillor and co-leader of the Progressive Group 2. So hello to you, Diana.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, you're most welcome. Great to have a guest on the show. But tell us, first of all, where you represent, which I think is St David's.
St David's, the heart of Exeter.
And the Progressive Group as well, which is the lefty-leaning part of the political spectrum.
Yeah, we are committed to working cross-party. We set up in 2019. There was four of us, two Liberal Democrats, one Green and Independent. And now there's a group of nine with three Liberal Democrats and six Greens. And I am a co-leader with my colleague, Mike Mitchell. And cooperation is the way to go.
And with nine, are there 39 councillors in Exeter?
That's right, yes. We're so the official opposition.
You bumped off the Conservatives, which must be quite an achievement.
They sit behind us on the green benches.
That makes you feel pretty good, I would imagine.
It's a different dynamic for the council, and we do take our job seriously, asking questions, holding the ruling group to account, and putting forward some fresh ideas.
So we'll start today, given we've got a Green in the form of Diana with us, with low traffic neighbourhoods, which you've been looking into this week, Bradley.
Yes, that's true. So low traffic neighbourhoods have been somewhat of a controversial topic in Exeter, but an announcement by the Department for Transport looks set to make them even more divisive this week. The government department said it wanted to crack down on anti-driver schemes, overzealous traffic enforcement and strengthened guidance for councils on 20 mile per hour limits. I spoke to Ian Frankham. He's a campaigner against LTNs in Exeter, and I asked him what he made of the government's intervention.
I think it's horses for courses, because they also say that LTNs can work. And I agree that they can work. However, in our case, it was really poorly thought out. It's poorly executed. One of the main benefits, so to speak, was to increase safety. Well, Ladysmith Road, a freedom of information to the Devon County Council, will show you that there were no accidents there in the last 5 years. Since they've had the LTN, they've had two accidents that we know of and many near misses due to the configuration now, which is far more dangerous than it was prior to.
So, as you heard there, Ian isn't fundamentally against LTNs as a concept, but believes, like the DfT statement also said, there should be a buy-in from local residents, businesses and emergency services when considering such schemes. He explained to me why he felt the implementation of Exeter's LTN got him involved in campaigning against it.
The council did do a consultation. They didn't need to by law, but it was very limited. It was online, so many elderly were excluded from it. And that showed when they had a public meeting around it, and people were queued around the park in Heavitry to register their concerns in relation to it. And I got motivated from that. So many elderly people not having a say. And as the LTN has been in progress, the impact it's had has just grown and grown and grown.
So both proponents and opponents have been vocal about the LTN in Exeter, and there are moves by Devon County Council as the Highways Authority to closely monitor the impact of it. Ian Frankham doesn't believe it has reduced pollution, simply concentrated it onto fewer roads. And he also isn't convinced it's made any of the streets surrounding the LTN any safer either. But in spite of his and the community's vocal opposition, he says it feels to local residents that they simply aren't being listened to.
The only real survey that's been undertaken, and I know those in favour of the LTN will say it's biased because it was undertaken by the Conservative Party. And trust me, I'm no Conservative, but it's the only real survey that's been undertaken. 1,700 letters through the doors, 85% said it wasn't working. And I guess the frustration in the community is that it appears that the local politicians really just aren't listening or even taking cognizance of the evidence that's kind of staring them in the face.
Diana, I know you're an Exeter City Councillor, not a Devon County Councillor, but he's saying the politicians aren't listening.
I don't think that's true. I think politicians are listening, and if they weren't before, they certainly are now. I mean, that has been a successful element of Ian's campaign. But, you know, I've been out speaking with residents, joining my Heavy Tree councillors in Heavy Tree, listening to people. And it's really interesting to hear what they have to say. And in fact, people aren't speaking with one voice. There was a whole range of views. There's people who really don't want it. There's people who really do want it. And there's a whole range of people in between who've got different experiences or can see benefits but have some difficulties and actually can understand why there is a trial in place. So it's complex and it's really exciting to see the community involved and taking such an active part in what they want the future of the neighbourhood to be.
Many of the people who are affected by this adversely are not saying this is exciting. They're saying it's actually disturbing their lives.
Yes, people are saying it's disturbing their lives, but people are also saying that issues such as air pollution is disturbing their lives. Children who can't get to school safely and people who are worried about people who rat run through their areas. There's all sorts of problems that this scheme is raising.
Have children not been getting to school safely in those areas over the decades?
Yes, people have found it quite difficult. And we know that when schemes are introduced to slow traffic, make it safer, then there's an increase in walking and cycling and scooting to school. And that can only be good for children's health and fitness, and improve air quality.
I just wonder whether there's any alternative really to this, because it does seem to be causing quite a lot of stress to people. Is there any other way of making it safer, better for pedestrians? Can you introduce more 20 mile an hour speed limits, or is there anything else you could do that maybe would be a more popular alternative?
I think we need to look at what's effective, and we do need to look at alternatives. There could be other things that could be done as well. But one of the facts of the matter is that in East Wandford Hill, where there's a lot of worry about, that has had illegal levels of air pollution for 10 years. Carry on doing the same thing and expecting a different result is not going to happen. So we have to be able to do something different. One of the things that is being proposed by the County Council now is improved bus priority. There's four sites that are being proposed across the city, and two of them will directly benefit Heavy Tree. And if we get buses to the front of the queues and getting them going sooner, then it will make public transport a more viable option. So we need to look at a whole range of things.
But isn't that a massive problem in Exeter? Like, you want to give buses priority, but the physical geography of the city just simply is going to make that so difficult and be so expensive to really achieve.
Bus priority lanes are a very cost-effective measure, easy to put in and doesn't take up more road space. One of the things that we have, we have 10 railway stations in Exeter. 10! That's absolutely fantastic, but they are underused resourced. They don't connect up well enough with the buses, and quite a lot of the people who are driving around Exeter are coming in from our rural areas. We have a massive travel to work area, and we are not working strategically with neighbouring districts to reduce that level of traffic. So actually, most of the congestion problems that we've had are problems we've had for years. Absolutely.
And here's one possible solution. You say a bus lane doesn't need any additional road space, but it does take away from road space, doesn't it? So if you go down the Topsham Road here in Exeter, where there's a bus lane in one direction, and you get a vehicle heading down there every 10 minutes or so, but Topsham Road is absolutely clogged with traffic. If we got rid of the bus lane, Diana, then you'd have more space for the traffic to flow more freely.
And then more buses would be stuck in a jam and nobody would use the buses and it would add to it. So we have to do things differently, and people's feedback through the processes. I mean, Ian talked about the consultation process being badly designed at the beginning, and that is right. And our councillors have been doing a lot of work to encourage people to respond to the live consultation that's now happening. And that's what we need, because then things can be changed, like the changes that happened with the bus gates. So things don't have to be put in stone. It is a trial period, and the evidence shows from elsewhere that as people think about how they're going to travel, when they're going to travel, that habits change, and so the impacts will change over the time of the trial. And actually elsewhere it has brought many positive benefits, particularly on air quality. We seriously need to address the illegal levels of air pollution in East Wandsworth Hill, and there's other sites around Exeter, particularly on Topsham Road, for example, that have really high levels of air pollution, which is not good for you.
So we can disperse that by sending the traffic onto other roads, which is one of the complaints that people are having, that this is just diverting the issue elsewhere.
Well, what happens over a period of time is people shift how they travel. So more people will walk and more people will cycle. And I had one woman who lived near to the Topsham Road, and as she was getting older, she was concerned about how she would cross the road. And I joined her one day. We went up to the junction with Barrett Road to look at how she would cross the road so she could walk to the hospital.
And that's very well if you're able to walk or if you're able to cycle. But as you get older, many people can't do that. We have people who have mobility issues who are more affected. We don't have the clip here, but I think in the programme you had last September, when there was a protest about County Hall, of people saying, I'm having to get taxis round to places now. Cost me £15, which used to cost me a fiver.
Yep. Well, it's not necessarily about older people. It's about people who become more frail. And being able to walk and cycle as long as you can helps people keep people fit. I cycle because I'm lazy. And if I didn't cycle, I probably wouldn't do a lot of other exercise. So I know that sounds weird, but I'm not exactly the slimmest person and it helps keep me fit. And so if more people feel confident about walking or cycling and crossing the road or cycling, then those journeys from the car will shift to walking and cycling, which will free up space for those that need it.
Is this just an assumption?
No, that is research. There's been research to show that. And both councils have...
Devon and Exeter.
Exeter, yep. And Devon have a target of 50% of journeys walking and cycling. That would make our air fresher to breathe, people fitter, and it would reduce congestion. And the impacts of congestion affects individuals, it affects businesses, it affects the city. But it does involve us changing our habits, and that's hard. But nobody is asking someone who is frail or unable to walk and cycle to do so. Absolutely need to be clear on that.
If I may just build on something Alison has just said, is could we do something else that people like, such as bringing in more 20-mile-an-hour zones? At the weekend, the government said they would be cracking down on councils who don't consult properly on these 20-mile-an-hour zones. So we don't have the situation that they had in Wales of introducing something which, when it goes into practice, is actually quite unpopular. I'm assuming you're a fan of reducing speed limits, but are we just entering another area of controversy?
Well, I have residents who've been writing to me, even though I'm not a county councillor, saying, we want 20 miles an hour down our street. So if we look at Haven Road, where the Clip and Climb is, had a cyclist knocked off in front of there last year, and people worry about the children coming out of there. People like 20 miles an hour because it's consistent speeds, and then it's less confusing for motorists. If you've ever driven from Cowick through to Exwick, and you know that then the road speed suddenly change, you're confused. If we have consistent roads, then it makes the traffic flow
better. It used to be 30.
No, but now there's a 20 and then there's a 30. So it's confusing. So it's consistent.
And why is that?
We don't have consistency of thought around of how things work together. And that's really infuriating.
Yeah, as has been obvious here, it's such a difficult issue. We did actually, obviously, contact Councillor Danny Barnes, who chairs the Exeter Highways and Traffic Orders Committee, which is the one that's agreed to implement the LTN or the LTN trial. But I didn't hear back from Councillor Barnes. I emailed and messaged and called him but didn't hear back. Devon County Council Stuart Hughes, the Cabinet Member for Highways, said in response to the DfT's intervention about cracking down on these things if they weren't properly consulted upon, that he welcomed clearer guidance around the democratic role that local communities have when councils are considering introducing schemes that encourage active travel.
This is Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. I'm Paul Nero. I'm with Bradley Gerrard and Alison Stevenson. And today as well, from the Green Party in Exeter, Diana Moore.
Devoncast
from Radio X.
And we're going to move on now from one city in Devon to our other city. Over to Plymouth and Alison.
Yeah, so Plymouth Civic Centre, that huge building that towers above the city, it's been redundant for 10 years and there's new plans to bring it back into life. The former council offices needs extensive work inside and out, and it's quite a complicated project, not least because it's covered in concrete cladding that needs replacing. Renovation costs have increased dramatically over the last 9 years, making it a less feasible option for private companies to invest in. Last week, Plymouth City Council announced it was planning to buy back the building for the £1 it sold it to developers for all those years ago, and says City College coming on board to open a new campus on the lower floors is a game changer for the project. The site has planning permission for 144 apartments on the upper floors. Councillor Mark Lowry, who's City Centre champion and the finance chief, tells us why the council is back in the game on the Civic Centre scheme.
Initially, the project was due to cost some £35 million, and we're now projecting it's going to cost somewhere in the region of £50 million. And therefore, the gap to undertake this work financially is prohibitive for a commercial company to undertake. They simply couldn't afford to do so, and they would make a considerable loss. We have been working hard to get additional funding. We've managed that, and so far we've achieved £18.5 million of additional funding for this project. And it'd be inappropriate for, in my view, a commercial developer to undertake this project and would get the benefit of the grant funding from our partners to undertake this project moving forward. So it's quite important that the council steps in, and any benefit and any profit derived in the future is held for the taxpayer, because it is the taxpayer who is ultimately providing this additional funding.
Given that the building is very old, there's lots of work on it. You've admitted to me that it's a complicated, complex building. What are the risks involved?
Well, any project of this scale, of course, will come with risks, but we've done an awful lot of previous survey work, and we've got a contractor in place to undertake the repairs necessary, and we've got a fixed price contract for taking this forward. So the risk that does exist is somewhat mitigated by us undertaking that survey work previously. So we've got two sets of funding. One is just over £10 million and one is £8.5 million. And that money will be used to renovate the building in two stages. The first stage, scaffolding and concrete repairs and minor demolitions of the former 1970s extension. And the second stage is to remove the existing cladding, installation of new cladding, roof repairs, fire protection, and all the services necessary along with the public realm. And that will allow City College to use the lower floors and commence their operations in 2026. In parallel with that, we will fit the building out in preparation for the accommodation works in the upper floors.
Okay, and the accommodation itself, what's that going to be?
That is going to be a mixed-use housing development, but it will not be, just to reassure you, it will not be a student accommodation in any way, shape or form. It will be homes for people to live in.
And will those be some affordable social homes and open market housing, a mixture of?
That is our plan at the moment, but equally it comes down to working with Homes England. They have a requirement for us to provide mixed tenure, which would include affordable housing. So once we've got to the stage, we've done those negotiations in detail, I can give you the specifics.
And what will this mean, this regeneration of this building itself for the whole of Plymouth?
Well, I think it's fundamentally important because we can't ask people to believe in our vision for a regenerated city centre. That's changing dramatically because shops are moving out of our city centre, as we know, and we want to encourage new businesses to open up, and we wish to encourage new people to live in our city centre, because we do not have enough people actually living in the city centre. And we can't convince people that we're serious about regenerating our city centre if we can't take on the most iconic building in our city, the one that everyone can see from walking around the city centre, that it needs to be regenerated. And that's why we stepped in now and brought forward this project, which will hopefully bring forward the regeneration we need.
That was Councillor Mark Lowry. Now, the landmark building's been called an eyesore by some people who think it should just be demolished. But equally, there are many others who like the postmodernist building, which was opened by the late Queen in 1962 and now listed. Here are some of the thoughts of residents I spoke to in the city on Monday.
Considering the housing crisis in Plymouth, which I am part of at the moment, I'm in temporary housing with my children, I think that could very well be turned into social housing for people.
I don't think that they should demolish the building. I think they should leave it. I think it should be probably mostly residential. And if they can do a deal with the City College so that people can have apprenticeships in things that the city needs, so marine and environment, possibly construction, then I think that's a really good idea, rather than just leave it to rot.
Well, I think it's, if it's not being used at the moment, it's silly, so you might as well use it for something. It's a good-looking building. Why not use it?
I don't know why they put a listing on it when the building's over here was older. They knocked that down for student accommodation. I disagree with that completely.
Now, City College Plymouth says it's been looking for a central spot for a campus for 18 months and has been working with the council to find one. Its King's Road campus is at capacity and the college plans for another 2,000 students and 60 courses at the Civic Centre by 2026. Chief Executive and Principal Jackie Grubb said this is a starting figure and the world is their oyster as far as the future is concerned, with the increasing demand for jobs in the marine and environmental sectors. She tells us here why Plymouth needs a new skills hub.
We've done a lot of work in terms of the labour market intelligence and what is needed to fulfil the skills gap. And health and active wellbeing and marine construction engineering, blue-green, has a large majority of jobs around Plymouth, but it does also it also does nationally. It aligns with the Plymouth plan, and we have a lot of partners and collaboration with our local employers. And we know what the jobs are out there. And at the moment, we haven't got the trained workforce to fulfil those skills gaps and those jobs. But we also must remember that blue and green threads through the fabric of any job, not just, you know, our STEM jobs. So it's needed, you know, in essence, because there is a skills gap. It's needed because the employers need to fill job vacancies. But also in a beautiful place like Plymouth, and the areas of deprivation, we need to realise the aspirations of our people to either train, upskill and develop them to their full potential.
That was Plymouth City College leader Jackie Grubb. She explained why it's so crucial and exciting to have a city centre campus.
Bringing something so cutting edge, so dynamic, is going to reimagine our city centre. The bus routes in the city centre are more regular, so access for people is going to be easier. It's very, very close to the train station, so again, accessibility is really, really important. And it will just bring such innovation and vibrancy to our city centre that lots of people talk about very often.
So you don't think that's going to be a hard sell then to get people here?
I think that a city centre location, an educational placing that will add to what's already there, the footfall for the restaurants and all the other places that are there at the moment, I think this is an absolute win-win for this beautiful ocean city of Plymouth.
Diana, you're an Exeter councillor, not a Plymouth one, clearly, but you must be thrilled to hear her talk about the blue and green infrastructure and the skills jobs for the future and see a redundant building come back into use.
It sounds like a great project and the college are clearly very excited, and what a coup for the council to get them there. I think there are parallels with Exeter in many ways, because the woman who first spoke in that Vox Pop talked about the housing crisis, and the council have done well to get that £18 million. So I was surprised when asked about will there be affordable housing. It said that was the plan at the moment. We need to have definite commitments by city leaders to be saying, yes, we want affordable housing. We want council housing. We want decent homes, not co-living boxes. This is what we need in our city centres.
Just remind people what co-living boxes, in your word, are.
OK, so basically it's a new form of accommodation, which is basically hotel-sized rooms, which are being extraordinary rents in extra £1,000 a room, which are being promoted as long-term living. And guess what? It's 70% full at the moment. There's rooms that are empty in this new building. So,
presumably that's just economics. If it's £1,000 per room per month, it's empty because that's too much money.
It absolutely is too much, and it's being foisted upon communities who are having to move out of the city centres because they can't afford to live in the cities that they love. And this is, we need decent, affordable homes right in the heart of our cities. And repurposing this tower block sounds a great idea. And so my challenge to the council would be, make it affordable, make it mixed development, but councils are there to serve our communities, not try and be housing.
And practically then, how do you make it affordable?
How do you make it affordable? Well, they've already got their £18 million to address their structural problems with that building. That's a significant sum. And they're in negotiation with Homes England, and they're the ones that will be providing some level of subsidy. But this project is getting a massive subsidy. So actually, we need to be making sure that actually people are put before the profit element because of the subsidy. That's dealing with that issue. Councils don't have to make the 20% profits that developers expect. So that return on that investment is the provision of affordable, social, decent homes that we need to address our housing crisis here in Devon.
Yeah, I was just going to say that plan for Plymouth City Centre is to build 5,000 homes in the next 5 years in the city centre itself. But I think that the thing is, it's Homes England as well to sort of say, yes, this is what you need, because Homes England are saying they want mixed tenure. So they want a mix of houses, but surely it should come from the government, you know, that social housing is really important and more subsidies should be given to that. I think, you know, it's something that should be coming down to local authorities.
We're going to talk about devolution in a moment. Diana, is this something that will come down in your understanding?
The money doesn't seem to be coming down. The money that's been offered is paltry amounts for all the things that are expected to be dealt with. So I don't see anything happening anytime soon. I mean, councils model their housing, their affordable and council housing, over a 50-year lifespan. So councils do have more wiggle room in terms of providing these things. But we need the government to do things like end the right to buy, because the councils don't get 100% of the money that is sold when somebody buys their council house. So the council's always on the back foot when it comes to investing. So government really needs to step up and invest if it's serious about addressing the affordable housing crisis.
And that's a national green policy, is it? Stop right to buy. So people who've been living in their council homes for many years, the prospect of them owning that home goes.
Yes, Green Party doesn't support the right to buy. In fact, it devastated my family. My family bought their house, their council house. I grew up in a council house. And for various reasons, it was in the 90s and the interest rates went up and they lost their house again. That was cutting a long story short. So it hasn't achieved its outcomes. And in fact, this is something that the local government association has been discussing recently. And actually, they have even concluded that the right to buy isn't working as intended. And actually, maybe it's time for a rethink.
This is Devoncast. I'm Paul Nero from Radio X. And this is the first Devoncast broadcast, rather than being just available as a podcast. So welcome if you're listening to us on digital radio. And you'll find us over and over and over and over again until you go dizzy, because we're only changing the programme in a fortnight. So you will have the opportunity to listen to this to your wit's end, really. And we're rotating with a small number of other programmes from Radio X too. So we've got rugby, we've got Building Greater Exeter on there as well, which you might be interested in listening to, which is an independent production. And as time goes by, Devoncast Radio will have more podcasts available made in or about Devon. So if you have a podcast, go to devoncastradio.co.uk and find out more about how to get your podcast to a wider audience across the county.
So yes, now on to devolution. Devon and Torbay sat down with members of the county's voluntary and community sector recently to discuss the proposed devolution plan by the two authorities. Now, for anybody that's missed discussions around devolution so far, the idea is that Devon County Council and Torbay Council would join forces to create a combined county authority, or CCA, which proponents say will have various benefits, including local control of skills and adult education budgets, greater access to green funding, and a more direct line to central government. So Devon and Torbay are keen to get everyone behind their vision, and the latest consultation event was aimed at discussing the proposal with the county's voluntary sector representatives. Diana Crump, the independent chair of the Torbay, Plymouth and Devon Voluntary Community and Social Enterprise Assembly, was in attendance. And while she initially felt that the presentation failed to recognise her sector's importance to the county, she was encouraged by comments from those in attendance from both councils.
We kind of felt it didn't seem to acknowledge the things that we bring to Devon, which are very much about working with communities, neighbourhoods, smaller villages. We bring lots of rural support, and we didn't feel that was necessarily recognised. I have to say, from the responses to us talking about that within the consultation, I was very, really encouraged, actually. Everybody seemed to recognise that that was something that we now need to change and need to have some conversations about.
And Lincoln Sargent, who's Torbay's Director of Public Health, he was also there and stressed that every sector was important to the proposed CCA and that his council and Devon were working to ensure a collegiate approach.
Well, what I think came out of the discussion is a willingness and openness to be inclusive. And I think there are many ways around doing that. So clearly, once the legislation is passed, there will be certain bits of the governance that's prescribed. But I think there's a willingness to ensure that all voices of all the different sectors are fed in through various bodies that are then able to influence the central governance bodies.
And he added that the creation of a CCA would mean Devon and Torbay speaking in a larger, more cohesive voice, meaning it would have a better chance of being able to lobby for the things it wants.
What we are doing is creating a mechanism that allows us to do certain things at scale that the different organisations can't achieve on their own. And some of that is, how do we tackle housing? How do we look at transport? You know, how do we look at our education and skills in a way that's more cross-boundary and allows us to use the economies of scale that Torbay and Devon together can bring?
And that was something that Devon's leader, John Hart, also reinforced, believing that the most important factor above initial pots of money was being a level closer to Whitehall's ear.
But the real point is, it's not the 16 million, which is useful. It's not the responsibility for training and skills, which is very useful in my view, that we can actually train people up and do the things that we want done in Devon and Torbay. It's the fact that we're close to the centre of London, if I put it this way, in a way that we're not at the present moment.
And you gave housing as an example, which is becoming a real issue in Devon in terms of both availability and affordability. Homes England, a central government quango set up to tackle the nation's housing crisis, is supposed to work with local authorities to help them bring forward affordable housing schemes. But all too often, money gets handed back to it because projects aren't approved or executed quickly enough. Councillor Hart believes that being a CCA could help it gain access to some of this unspent cash.
Over the last few years, it's paid back to the Treasury over £4.7 billion of unspent money. Could have been spent on low-cost and social housing. Even this last year, they've given back £1.7 billion. Now, if we can't get fingers into some of that because of where we are, it's a bad job.
Now, I think that's a really interesting point that John raises. He's saying that this CCA is going to have a greater pull, a greater, be more visible to government. Dan, I don't know, what do you think about that? Do you think that's a valid argument, that Devon and Torbay combined will get more things that they ask for from government if they're speaking in this cohesive voice?
It may be more visible to government, but is it going to be visible and relevant to communities? And that's the first contribution that we've heard from Diana Crump, was actually about that. Are communities going to make sure that their needs are met rather than actually the interests of government, which could be argued is sucking up powers? I think there does need to be strategic working across the county, but we have a very diverse county, and so we need to make sure that all perspectives are included in that well, and the governance structures are quite thin and quite oriented towards government, not oriented towards district, town, parish councils who are working directly with the communities that we are here to serve.
Is Exeter City Council, or are you on its behalf, worried about if the CCA does go ahead, Exeter's voice might get sort of crowded out ever so slightly?
I don't think it's a case of if. We've been told it will. It is an issue that we've been having discussions about in terms of, you know, will Exeter as a city have an appropriate voice? We need to have recognition of the difference between the urban centres and the rural areas and the coastal areas. But we also need to be able to work together effectively. We were talking about transport earlier. You know, we can't make the most of our 10 train stations unless we have a joined up plan across the whole of Devon. And so, you know, on the plus side, if I look at Cornwall and what's happened with their devolution, they have significantly improved public transport in a way that we can only dream of at the minute. So, you know, this is how we have to work to make sure that we're really clear about the difference we want to make for the communities and get on and do it. The amount of money that's been presented, the £16 million, of which £1 million is going to be tucked up in setting it up, isn't going to go very far on all these really, really important issues. You can spend £16 million in a trice just on housing.
But you'll have to spend it in a trice, won't you? Because these structures are not going to be in until the autumn, and that money's got to be spent by the end of next March. So they're going to need these projects really quickly, and presumably this is just seed funding to try and get more money for future projects at a time when we possibly have a new government.
Indeed, and I suppose that's the hope amongst some, that if this is in place then there's a body with which the new government can have a dialogue with. But these decisions are made in a hurry and repented at leisure, and actually we need to have a strategic approach to sustained investment. Beyond the £16 million, there's no promise of any other money. So, you know, we can plan, but we need to see things happening. We've spent ages planning in Devon and districts and all sorts of stuff, but we don't have the money to make things happen. Government makes us jump through hoops to actually keep applying for funding. It's such a waste of public funding to have to be able to do that all the time.
And this might be a solution to it once it comes into fruition.
It has to be, because if it isn't, then what are we doing? We're just creating the same problem again.
Am I getting the sense that you probably think this is not a great idea? Councils have been starved of funds, really, haven't they, since, well, for the last 10, 12 years. Would it be better just to give the existing structures more money? And if so, where does that money come from?
OK, so decisions should be made at the local, most local level possible. That's a really good principle for operating. So this is why I fundamentally believe in things like district councils and parish councils have a really important role to play, because they are connected. And then if something can't be resolved at that level, then it needs to be referred up to a higher body that works across a wider area or does more specialist things. So the government has chosen that it has chosen a programme of austerity which has run down its local authorities. And we're really seeing the impact of that now with our housing crisis, people who are homeless, and all the other services that we're going to be hearing about in terms of mental health and all the rest of it. And that is a political choice. We do have enough money to invest in these local authorities. And
arguably,
do a great job.
Arguably, the government would say we don't have enough money. That's why we've been cutting back over the years.
They have chosen to make these cuts on local authorities. They have chosen to spend their money on elsewhere, on projects that have been a waste of money. And we know that for all the money that is, you know, the government has cut local authorities' powers, hasn't given it the right powers to act and taken those away, sucked them up to the centre. And now we're trying to do our best for our communities with one hand tied behind our back whilst we're hopping with the other and going, yeah, everything's fine. Well,
you
it's
don't
not.
Hop with your hands.
Sorry. Oh, no, the foot.
Bradley.
So, yeah, I guess finance is obviously a key point, but John Hart's point is that he will have, not just him, you know, Devon and Torbay combined will have the ear of civil servants, was his point. He's like, yes, governments change, but civil servants don't. So that was really important. So he's kind of confident, although, like you say, you can only see so far into the future in terms of what money's available. But he feels confident that having that closer connection to Whitehall and civil servants will be beneficial and will help secure more money.
I know it's very easy and neat for government to be able to have one person in one area to deal with, and that's why they like the mayors. But actually, we've seen some of the combined authorities becoming very, very political, not focused on dealing with civil servants, but actually becoming very political animals that are some detached from their communities. And that's really what we need. And we do need ministers to understand the complexity of what it means to be living in rural Devon, or having a massive travel to work Exeter, to travel to work area to Exeter. We need them to understand that there is life outside of London, and actually it isn't just organised neatly by one body. But yes, if Councillor Hart is right and it gives us more influence, then of course that's got to be a good thing. But we have to be careful we don't throw that away and undermine local democracy.
It's worth saying that Devon did apply for the version of a combined county authority that does not involve an elected mayor. But still, I understand your point that it's I guess, a curious situation we're in, whereby we're essentially creating another level of government, whereas maybe the solution should be that what we have already just works better.
Brad, I know you've been to one of these consultation events. So have I. Diana, have you been to one of the events?
Councillors have had events where the county have come to us and we've had various consultations. But you're not consulting on whether it's going to happen or not. It's a fait accompli, it's just kind of...
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is this a consultation? It didn't feel like that to me. I felt pretty much that this was going to go ahead.
Well, the phrase that caught my ear there was that it was a consultation, not a referendum. Yes, it is a consultation, but in effect, what I was told is that there has been no official opposition to this from any other body that's ostensibly involved or impacted. So there are reservations, don't get me wrong. No formal opposition doesn't mean there aren't concerns, but there's been no organisation saying we are formally against this, do not do it. It's more of a, we're going to watch, and there are things we are going to watch very carefully.
So the consultation ending about now, actually. So by the time people hear this, it will have passed. Does it need legislation?
Yes, so there was a very long example. I won't give you every blow-by-blow of it, but the nutshell version is that by about October, November, if everything goes to plan, legislation will be passed to create this CCA.
Regardless of whether there's an election in the intervening period.
Well, who can answer that question with any certainty?
Devoncast.
From Radio X.
This is Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service, your fortnightly podcast, but round and round on a loop on Devoncast Radio across the south of the county too. Alison.
A year ago, Torridge heard it was in line for £20 million of levelling up funding, and work has now begun to identify the projects which aim to bring the area out of deprivation. Chief Executive of the South West Business Council, Paul Coles, has been appointed to chair the Torridge Place Board, and that's a board that's going to drive forward ideas, but he admits they need to hit the ground running to spend the money before the deadline. Decisions on projects will ultimately be made by the Department for Levelling Up Communities and Food, but here's Paul to tell us about the part he will play and where he thinks the opportunities are.
The government is looking to turn the dial on a number of dynamics, one of which is the average gross value add, or you sometimes hear it called GVA, in our region because it's relatively low. The other one is to look at how we might impact gross median weekly pay. So in other words, create opportunities for people to have better paid long-term systemic jobs, and also to impact on the qualifications that people are attaining. And then finally, to look at health and life expectancy, because there's opportunities for improvement there. But in summary, for me, I'm really keen on the opportunities that create long-term, sustainable, well-paid jobs for people in Torridge.
How do we know that the money's not going to be kind of all soaked up in bureaucracy and lots of different teams deciding on things? How do we know the money's going to get to where it needs to go and soon?
No, it's a fair challenge. So firstly, community engagement is out there. Part of the board membership includes both business as well as people from local authorities and across third sector organisation. And of course, Sir Geoffrey Cox, our MP, is also on the board. So there will be a good deal of scrutiny, and that's part of the place board's role in how the money is spent and the success of the projects. There isn't, frankly, going to be time to hang around, because if there's one big challenge in all of this, it's that the money has got to be spent by the end of March 2025. So we really don't have time to be debating massively about how the money is used. We have to get really focused around delivering those benefits and delivering them rapidly.
Where do you think the opportunities are?
The first thing to say is Torridge sits within a UNESCO biosphere, one of four in England, 700 approximately across the globe, and that represents 5% of the Earth's surface. So we are operating in a really fascinating environment, and we're seeing a lot of businesses now get very focused on their impact on the environment and also create commercial opportunity around the environment. So just to give two examples, one in the biosphere territory, we're looking at aquaculture and seaweed and seagrass production. That's incredibly exciting because you can do things like create food packaging from aquaculture. You can create potentially fuels from aquaculture. So these are all environmentally focused opportunities that, that we can have in the northern Devon and specifically the Torridge area. But also the council did an absolutely brilliant job in securing the funding for the new Appledore Clean Maritime Innovation Centre. That's £16 million worth of investment that is going to look at how you decarbonize shipping and specifically the fueling of shipping. That's a brilliant facility that will be built in Appledore. And I'm hoping that with the place board, we can look at how we can build on that and create even greater opportunity for the people in Torridge.
£20 million of levelling up funding. Diana, going into Torridge, it sounds like a great green opportunity there.
Certainly sounds like an opportunity for some very interesting jobs to be created, and that is the way the business needs to go. So that is really very interesting. It's also very interesting to point out the range of issues that they're looking to tackle. Tackling health inequalities and life expectancy is a really difficult one, and that's going to take a long-term approach to having to tackle that. So it'd be really interesting to see how they're going to work directly with people affected to make those change. What I'd love to see, do you know what I'd really love to see in one of these projects, is giving people in a neighbourhood £1 million. What would you spend that on in your neighbourhood to tackle these issues and get local people to decide in that neighbourhood what's going to happen? That would be a really fascinating experiment.
I know they've got two workshops going on, engaging local people to come up with some really good ideas, because I don't think there is, you know, one overall idea at the moment. But given that the just over 10% of the promised funds have actually been spent from levelling up funding and making a difference on the ground, how do you think this is actually going to help the people it needs to?
They need to be clear about what they're trying to change at the beginning and then actually measure that. So many projects are put in place not knowing clearly what the outcome is you're expected to achieve.
It's all very nice, Diana, saying let's give £1 million and come up with your own ideas, but don't we find, as we did with the low traffic neighbourhoods, that everybody's got a different opinion, so somebody has to make the decision? And £1 million actually isn't a lot, is it?
No, it's not a lot. And yet people do have to make the decision, and you have to be clear about what you're going to decide on and what you're not going to be able to decide on. And that's where consultation often goes wrong, because people think it's either a referendum or you're consulting on all the options. In fact, if you talk to people, quite often you can build a consensus, or you can come up with two or three ideas. What has to be focused on is making sure that process works to have those discussions. And I do that with my job, so I know it can be done, and you can have brilliant results of that, because then you get people's buy-in to making that change happen. So if we all focused on the question of what would improve life expectancy or health outcomes or air pollution, then actually we would have a whole range of ideas that we had even not thought out of, and we can get them then tested out by experts who've studied this for years. Would that work? Has that been done? And together come up with solutions.
Alison, you'll know better than me on this one, but isn't there, there's a beach somewhere where people are a bit upset that the wind farm off the North Devon coast, the pipes or the bits of kit or whatever it is, lands on their beach. And although they like the idea in principle, in practice, again, this is splitting opinion.
Yeah, that's Saunton Sands, actually. Braunton. I mean, offshore wind power is a really big thing for North Devon. So, you know, potentially lots of jobs and money that could come into the area. But the consultation hasn't been that great on it, and the people are not on board with it. And the pipes are coming through an area of outstanding natural beauty and various sites of scientific interest and the Braunton Borough's biosphere. So the public really would like those pipes to be diverted or maybe used with another scheme, because there's quite a lot of schemes that are coming in to that part of the county. So they're saying let's join it up and maybe use the same pipes. But they just feel like there's not been enough consultation on it, really. And people are just not happy because, they love their beach and their community relies on seasonal income. That whole hub of the work is going to be taking up part of the car park for 4 years. So, it's going to make a big impact on the community there.
Communities do have to grapple with these questions, and if we want a renewable future, we have to think about how we deal with things like wind turbines. Some people love them, and they are part of our becoming increasingly part of our landscape and our seascape.
Isn't a recurring theme of every topic we've talked about the importance of consultation? And actually, people don't get interested in talking about this or talking about process. It's only when the pipes land on their beach that they see the practicality of it. It's only when the plant pots go up so they can't drive the cars down the street that they get involved in the practicality of it. And no matter how much you say, let's consult more, you only get the activists there consulting.
It's not always just the activists. The activists play an important role because activists can raise the voices, raise awareness to others in the ways that councils or other bodies can't. But consultation is important, and I think there is an important element to understand what's going to be done, what the options are, what's not being considered, who makes the decision. And sometimes we're a bit slapdash, I think, about saying, oh, well, we'll just put a little survey out there and then that's tick box done. That's what leads to problems. So I think, one of the pieces of work that I initiated within Exeter City Council is we now have a consultation charter, which sounds terribly dull, but actually it does set that out. What should be consulted on, how you go about it, what's considered, what's not, who makes the decision. People need to know that stuff.
And is that in place or are you still consulting on it?
Oh, no. That's all been done and been consulted on. And we are holding feet to the fire in terms of is it happening. And recently it stood the test over consultation on the allotment service. So I'm pleased it's there.
This is Devon Cast from Radio X and the local Democracy Reporting Service. I'm Paul Nero, Diana Moore, our guest from the Green Party from Exeter City Council, Bradley Gerrard and Alison Stevenson with us today.
So now on to the North Devon Link service. Campaigners were hoping to save it and they were bitterly disappointed at Devon's recent cabinet meeting where a decision was taken to close the mental health service. But just hours later, Devon's Health and Adult Care Scrutiny Committee Chair, Councillor Sarah Randall-Johnson, called the decision in for review. This means that councillors will look again at the cabinet decision, which if maintained, would see the drop-in centres in Barnstable, Bideford and Ilfracombe closed. I spoke to Terry Elliott from Ilfracombe Town Council after the cabinet meeting, who said she has been campaigning to keep the centres open for 2.5 years. And she spoke to me about her disappointment, which is really palpable in this clip.
Absolutely disgusted. This whole process has been so, what can I say, it's been so disrespectful, there's been so many misrepresentations of information, consultations that haven't been fit for purpose, that have had to be thrown out, and this is all whilst people who are attending the Link Centres are people who are experiencing chronic mental ill health or periods of acute mental ill health, and the way they've been treated has added to their anxiety, added to their stress, added to their fear of the future. This decision is just disgusting.
I also spoke to Councillor Paul Crabb, who's the County Councillor for Ilfracombe, and he welcomed the fact that the decision would now be reviewed. This was particularly the case as he felt there was some uncertainty about the actual availability of services that are supposed to be lined up to replace the Link service if it's eventually closed.
I think it's a good process in the fact that it's given everybody an opportunity to have one more look at it. It depends what you describe as optimistic. I mean, I understand the rationale, what the cabinet's trying to do. What I am saying is the other alternatives haven't been explained to members. And I don't think if members don't know what the alternatives are or if there are alternatives, then I don't think that members can, in all honesty, vote for closing existing service. I understand why it's got to be closed, but I think it's too early unless members know what's going to replace it.
Councillor Crabb added that there also appeared to be confusion emerging from the council's officers, with some stating that access to mental health services was particularly difficult, and others stating that difficulties securing help were low.
It's quoted in the report as saying, like, the access to mental health services is particularly difficult. That's been written in a Devon County Council report on one desk, whereas the next desk over is saying everything's fine. That's where I am with this, and that's why I think the members need to know more.
So, yeah, just as we came into the podcast, I was listening to the scrutiny committee meeting that was reviewing this decision. So the Cabinet had voted to close the link centres. The scrutiny committee has not gone against that. However, what it was really keen to press home on was that it really wanted to see a fundamentally written down, obvious plan for what's going to happen to these service users. So if the link centres do close down, these people that rely on it, and there was a lady in there who was very emotional about its impact on her life, if the link centres close, what actually is there going to be for people? That's what the scrutiny committee really pushed forward. And that motion was only voted through just about 7 councillors to 5, so it was very close.
And so this is a, for want of a better phrase, a stay of execution now whilst they review again?
Kind of, yeah. So what the scrutiny committee is asking for is a cast iron plan of, OK, Cabinet, you said we need to close these link centres. They're costing too much money. The NHS is now receiving central government money to provide a mirror service, so we can't both run it.
Back to our underlying theme, which is about consultation, Diana. In your experience, these scrutiny committees actually have teeth, do they? That this decision can change?
If the Cabinet or executive is wise, then they should listen to their scrutiny committees. And what is being clear through this campaign is what an invaluable service this is to local people. And that from the campaigners' point of view, they feel very angry that their concerns, real deep concerns that affect people's lives in a very deep way, have not been listened to. So people are going to be feeling like they've been got to the edge and they have nowhere to go. And that can be so isolating for people who are mentally ill.
And this must be very difficult also, because all councillors will have heard what's in that committee this morning, that they have to make a decision based on people's lives but also on taxpayers' money, and so you're making balances all the time. It can't be easy for you as councillors.
No, and the worst thing is that when money is ring-fenced, people will say, oh, you're spending money on this and you're not spending on that, which is more important. And that's really, really difficult to explain to people. But we also need to make sure that there is really importantly, that there is really good scrutiny of council finances. So we need to have committees in place that look at how money is spent, that there's clarity of monitoring council finances. You know, this is my 5th year as a council, looking at council budgets and how they work is like a dark art. And actually we need to make sure there's really good training and we really understand how these work. And I'd really encourage the public to get involved in that process. There is you can be involved in the public in an audit of the council. I'd encourage that, because anything that makes councils spend their money more wisely, challenges decisions that are made, can only be a good thing.
And I think that's actually a part of the key challenge here. So because, as I was sort of suggesting before, there's Devon County Council doesn't quite have the responsibility now for this service. So to keep paying nearly £500,000 a year or whatever it is into it doesn't obviously make sense on the taxpayers' money argument. The NHS, there were health representatives there at the scrutiny meeting, and there is clearly a very good potential framework there to support these service users. But the thing that came up again and again from councillors is it's will, might, could, and they were worried how concrete those things would be. And that's what the councillors who are, I think, against the closure of the centres are just really concerned, that as you pass this service from one entity, being Devon County Council, to the other, NHS, just making sure that that handover, that passing of those service users, is actually cohesive, coherent, and looks after them.
Seems a good place to stop. If you want to get involved in the democratic process, keep listening to Devoncast Radio, check out the website and get in touch with our local democracy reporters.
Myself, Bradley, who covers Devon County Council and Mid-Devon District Council.
I'm Alison at radiox.co.uk, and I cover Plymouth, North Devon, Torridge and West Devon.
Guy Henderson will be back next time, guy at radiox.co.uk. He covers Exeter City Council, Teignmouth District Council, Torbay Council. Does he do any more? He's multi-talented. Meltdown Townsend as well. And Will at radiox.co.uk. Will Goddard, who does East Devon. This is Paul Nero. Thank you for listening to Devoncast on Devoncast Radio or our podcast. Diana, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll come back another time.
Love to, thank you.
And all the listeners too. Goodbye.
Devoncast
from Radio X.